Lecture 70, The Cold War.
Last time, we saw how President Truman's decision to use the atomic bomb finally ended the Second World War in the Pacific. The existence of such weapons remained absolutely central to post-war geopolitics and then conditioned everything which happened subsequently. The Second World War didn't end with a general peace treaty. There was nothing the equivalent of Versailles after World War II. The principal victors, America and the Soviet Union, disagreeing over the future of Eastern Europe and ideologically hostile to each other, fell out almost at once. Britain, severely weakened by the war, signaled to President Truman that it could no longer maintain its worldwide imperial policy. Truman made the momentous decision not to revert to the customary American policy of isolationism, but rather to take up the burden of world leadership that Britain had relinquished. A temporary dividing line drawn through Europe became permanent. Winston Churchill described it as the Iron Curtain. Soviet possession of nuclear weapons by 1949 created a geopolitical stalemate. Neither side could afford to upset the balance of terror. Nuclear weapons were much cheaper to maintain than conventional armies and were thus attractive as the foundations of American defense policy. Nevertheless, their proliferation over the ensuing decades to a point of mutual assured destruction caused anxiety and an intense moral debate about their legitimacy inside the United States. Well, first of all, the disagreement among the victors after the war. They couldn't disagree about how nations liberated from the Nazi empire should be disposed. Roosevelt, and then his successor Truman, believed that the European countries liberated from Germany should hold free elections. That is, they should be democratically self-determining. The big three leaders, the leaders of Britain, America, and the Soviet Union, met periodically during the Second World War, first at Tehran in Iran in November 1943, then at Yalta in the Crimea in 1945, in February, and then a few months later at Potsdam in Germany in July 1945, just after the fighting had finished, to discuss war policy and the post-war situation. Now, in retrospect, it's clear that Roosevelt was too trusting of Stalin and too sceptical about Churchill, whom he regarded, well, not unreasonably, as a reactionary imperialist. Churchill had been quite explicit about the idea that he wanted to prevent the breakup of the British Empire if possible. Churchill said to Roosevelt, "Let's get together before the Yalta meeting so that we can plan a strategy with which to greet Stalin's demands." But Roosevelt refused to do so. So tensions and mistrust among the three Allied leaders were already evident before the fighting finished. Stalin, the Soviet leader, was determined to create a pro-Soviet zone inside Eastern Europe. And his armies were in place, enabling him to enforce his will. One of the first things he did was to order the assassination of key anti-communist leaders in Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. So already within a year of the fighting finishing, Churchill, in a speech at Fulton, Missouri, coined the phrase Iron Curtain. He said, "From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent of Europe." And that phrase stuck and became the name for the demarcation point between the Western pro-American side and the Soviet sphere of influence east of that. Churchill said that he hoped that America would lead an alliance of the Western nations after the war, just as it had led the wartime alliance. Meanwhile, Poland, Eastern Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania all became satellites of the Soviet state, with Yugoslavia semi-independent under the communist leader Tito. Periodic revolts, for example, revolts by the Czechs in 1948 and again in 1968, and by the Hungarians in 1956, were repressed by Soviet troops with great brutality. And the Americans were powerless to intervene except at the risk of full-scale nuclear war. These regimes remained very, very repressive. For example, a while ago I went to Sachsenhausen, one of the Nazi death camps near Berlin, and the guides there told us that When it was liberated from the Nazis, it was at once converted into a Soviet concentration camp, where Stalin exterminated all his political rivals, just as Hitler had exterminated his. In other words, it had a continuous life through the end of the Second World War and right through into the 1960s. Well, in the decades after the Second World War, the Iron Curtain became not only a political dividing line, but also an economic one. Economic growth rates were far slower in the centralized economies of Eastern Europe. There was no competition among different manufacturers. Industries were very, very heavily bureaucratized. They had a cumbersome central direction. And a cynicism and resentment spread through the workforce, whose productivity was correspondingly low. There was also very severe environmental deterioration and destruction in the Soviet zone, making Poland and East Germany and parts of Czechoslovakia some of the most polluted places in the whole world. And the people of Eastern Europe, bitterly resenting Soviet domination and longing for the kind of prosperity and freedom they began to hear about in the West, felt themselves to be imprisoned. A great yearning for blue jeans and the music of the Beatles and the abundance which was developing in the West at the same time that their own societies remained crimped and starved and repressed. Well, the end of the Second World War led to a realignment of the world powers. Britain, in particular, had a very uncertain future, and the British Empire clearly could no longer maintain its position in the world powers. At the very end of the Second World War, Winston Churchill was voted out as the British Prime Minister and was replaced by the Labour Party, a Labour Party government under the leadership of Clement Attlee. The British people admired Churchill as a war leader, but did not think he'd be a suitable leader at the beginning of peacetime, and so he was replaced by Labour. And whereas Churchill had wanted to hold on to the British Empire, Attlee was committed to the idea that it ought to be let go. That's why the British Empire devolved very quickly in the late 1940s, with India gaining its independence, and then the Palestine Mandate developing into the creation of the State of Israel. Britain, although it was on the winning side of the war, was absolutely exhausted by the stress and strain of the war and could no longer take on the world policing role it had had in the preceding century. President Truman, therefore, had to make the decision whether he was going to take over that role or whether he was going to follow the pattern of withdrawing from European affairs, just as the United States had withdrawn after the First World War. And in the end, he made the momentous decision not to withdraw, but rather to remain committed to a far more active worldwide foreign policy. For example, Britain had been supporting anti-communist regimes in Greece and Turkey, which were fighting against communist guerrillas. Truman said he was willing to take on that role in 1947 to prevent the continued spread of communism there. He made an important address to Congress in March 1947, March the 12th, 1947, in which he outlined the conflict of two great civilizations, and this became known as part of the Truman Doctrine. Quote, "At the present moment in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life. The choice is too often not a free one. One way of life is based upon the will of the majority and is distinguished by free institutions, representative government, free elections, guarantees of individual liberty, freedom of speech and religion, and freedom from political oppression. The second way of life is based upon the will of the minority forcibly imposed upon the majority. It relies upon terror and oppression, a controlled press and radio, fixed elections, and the suppression of personal freedoms. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. In other words, America is going to accept the role of trying to forestall communist revolution wherever it might the possibility of it might appear." It's quite clear, by the way, that the Greek and Turkish regimes weren't really democratic. They were the first of many less than ideal regimes which the American government backed in the ensuing years, really solely because they were anti-communist. And one of the ethical dilemmas of American foreign policy has always been, how unscrupulous a regime can the American government support from the knowledge that if it doesn't, it might have to put up with something much worse afterwards. That's been one of the unsettling questions of American foreign policy over the last half century. An influential American diplomat named George Kennan conceived the policy principle which governed American foreign policy throughout the Cold War. It's called containment. And it was containment against the hazard of the constant spread of communism worldwide. Kennan said, incidentally, he was a 42-year-old diplomat in the American embassy in Moscow. And he sent what was now remembered as the long telegram from Moscow explaining the sources of Soviet conduct and the ways in which the Americans ought to come to terms with it. He said, "We need to meet the Soviet challenge everywhere through the adroit and vigilant application of counterforce at a series of constantly shifting geographical and political points." Usually diplomatic telegrams are terse and very much to the point. Here was a telegram which was 8,000 words long, one of the long telegrams of American history. But it was brilliantly successful in that it was recognized as a summary of the way in which the Americans ought to think about their world task from now on. And it emphasizes all the important points. Wherever in the world we see communist advances, we should be ready to oppose them. That's really why the Americans found themselves in subsequent years fighting in places as remote from the United States as Korea and Vietnam. Now, the Marshall Plan dedicated American resources to the economic revitalization of Western Europe. Western Europe had been shattered by the fighting which had taken place there, and by the very heavy bombing of Britain by the German air forces, and then the even heavier bombing of Germany by the British and American air forces. At graduation day at Harvard in 1947, Truman's Secretary of State, George Marshall, proposed what became known as the Marshall Plan. This was the offer of American money for the rapid rebuilding of the industrial infrastructure of Western Europe. It was certainly a generous offer, but it was also a self-interested offer, in that by now the economic wisdom was, it's much better to rebuild strong and healthy nations than to have one of them be artificially weakened, as had been the original plan at the end of the First World War, to keep Germany weak. Now the idea was, we've got to rebuild Germany, a democratic Germany, as strongly as possible, because it's going to become a central part of our defences against the possibility of Soviet aggression. See, already by 47, although it's still just 2 years since the war against the Germans, already they're being reconceived as more like an ally than an antagonist. And the Soviet Union, America's old ally, is now clearly reinterpreted as the antagonist. America had learned after the First World War that its own prosperity and stability depended on its potential rivals and customers also being economically strong, not feeble. Now, the Marshall Plan itself, because it was a highly successful policy, which led to the rapid rebuilding of the Western European economies, it was one of the contributors to the great economic disparity between Western and Eastern Europe throughout the Cold War years. Marshall invited the nations of the Eastern Bloc, Eastern Europe, also to participate in the plan, but the Soviet government prohibited the Eastern Europeans from participating, from fear that they'd then be drawn into the Western capitalist orbit, leaving Soviet Russia once more isolated. The Marshall Plan gave over $12 billion to Europe for rebuilding, and it was money incredibly well spent. In 1949, NATO came into existence, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which formally converted Germany from an enemy into an ally. And its creation followed American victory, American success, in the Berlin Airlift, which was one of the first flashpoints of the Cold War. Here's what had happened. It's a little bit complicated because it requires some knowledge of German geography. Berlin was right in the center of East Germany, the zone which had been overrun by Russian tanks at the end of the war and was completely inside the Soviet zone. But because it had been the capital of Hitler's Germany and was a symbolically important place, Berlin itself was divided up into originally four zones, a Russian one, an American one, a British, and a French. very quickly, that was simplified into two, the Russian zone in the east and the Allied zone in the west. Now, the Allies, the West Germans and the Americans, were given access routes through East Germany from the west to the city of Berlin itself, so that they could bring supplies and personnel in and out of the city of Berlin. It was it remained one of the hot spots of the Cold War throughout the ensuing years. And in 1948, the Soviets speculated that they might be able to get rid of this anomaly, in other words, take over the whole of Berlin. Their method of doing so was to cut the access roads, which ran through East Germany, because that presented the Americans with the challenge: if you want to get to Berlin now, you've got to fight your way through. Well, rather than do that, rather than escalate the military situation, the Americans took an alternative approach: we'll fly over the blockade. And so for about 9 months in 48 and 49, American supply planes flying from West Germany brought supplies into West Berlin to keep West Berlin alive. And they're remembered in German history as the Raisin Bombers. It's very poignant. If you go to the German Museum, the National Museum in Bonn today, you can actually find a model of an American bomber plane made out of raisins. And the idea was this: raisins were one of the foods which the planes brought in to German children, particularly in West Berlin. And it's poignant because very often these are the same planes which just 2 or 3 years previously had been dropping bombs on the German people. Now they're bringing in food and oil and supplies to keep the German people alive. So a dramatic change in their function. After this 9-month standoff, the Soviet Union itself backed down and reopened the supply routes. So Truman's resolve appeared to have won the Berlin crisis on terms favorable to the West. That was an event which cemented West German friendship for and admiration of the Americans, which persisted throughout the Cold War, the West Germans' admiration. But the creation of NATO and American leadership of NATO added new dilemmas, new complexities to American foreign policy. Another key member of NATO was France. But France was, although France had been defeated by Hitler, it continued to have aspirations to world power status. The French in particular wanted to regain their colonial empire in North Africa and in Southeast Asia, Vietnam among other places. And so the French made a condition of their participation in NATO American help in restoring their colonial empire. The Truman government felt very uneasy about that because they certainly preferred to be on the side of anti-colonialism. But because they regarded Western Europe as the most important zone of the Cold War, they reluctantly participated in helping the French Empire to attempt to reconquer its colonies in Southeast Asia, again with very, very grave long-term consequences, which we'll look at a little bit later in the course. In 1956, another great dilemma came up, forcing awkward decisions on the Allied powers. What happened in 1956 was that the Egyptian leader, Nasser, seized and nationalized the Suez Canal, which was owned and run by an Anglo-French consortium. In response, the British Army and the French, in collaboration with Israel, organized an attack to retake the canal zone from the Egyptians, which they regarded as an act of barefaced aggression. But President Eisenhower wanted to prevent an attack of this kind. Eisenhower himself was very, very eager to conciliate developing third world nations like Egypt and didn't want his own allies attacking them in this high-handed way. And so Eisenhower had to decide, am I going to support my English and French allies, or am I going to turn against their policy for the sake of cultivating client states in the third world? And in the end, he decided he would cultivate the clients. So he made various economic threats against Britain and France, forcing them to stop their military adventure to retake the canal zone. This is remembered as the Suez Crisis, and it's a clear indicator that Britain was no longer capable of undertaking independent imperial adventures. From now on, its policies had to be subordinated to those of the United States. Nuclear weapons development continued, and in fact accelerated, after the end of the Second World War and became a decisive factor in the post-war geopolitical situation. The first Soviet atom bomb was exploded in 1949, America tested its first hydrogen bomb, the next generation of even more powerful weapons, just a year or two after that in 1952. The rapid escalation in explosive power of these bombs was matched by a rapid development of the delivery systems, that is, ways of getting them onto an enemy target. These were years in which the conversion from propeller planes to jet aircraft took place. The very first jets had flown in the last years of the Second World War. And once again, German scientists were very, very important in both groups. At the end of the war, the Americans had got hold of all the German scientists they could, aviation and rocket scientists, and so had the Russians. The mood of this period of the Cold War is very well summed up in the movie The Right Stuff, the early scenes of it, in which you follow the test pilots who in the late 40s and early 50s are flying new generations of advanced jet planes one by one. The job, obviously, was to create a very high-speed, very accurate aircraft which could deliver nuclear weapons against an enemy target without being shot down on the way. The heavy bombers culminated in the creation of the B-52, the massive jet-powered nuclear bomber. There was also an intense interest in rocketry because everybody understood that. If you can have a guided missile carrying the weapon, you're no longer dependent upon the anxieties of and the fallibility of a human pilot to deliver the weapon. The guided missile will do it instead. The 50s was, of course, the decade in which the first spaceship took off, the Russian Sputnik. And it was a source of absolute amazement and horror to the Americans to see that the Russians had got ahead of them. The first generation of American rockets kept blowing up on the launching pad and going wrong in various ways. So the launching of Sputnik was a kind of clarion call to the American rocket scientists that they'd got to improve their own technology. Everybody knew that, although Sputnik simply carried a little satellite into space, and then the Russians followed up with a dog, and then with the first astronaut, Yuri Gagarin. These are rockets which can carry warheads. Everybody knew that. So the space race in the late 50s and through the 60s, culminating in the American moon landing in 69, is outwardly peaceful, but with profound military implications just half a step behind. Nuclear weapons were attractive, in a way, because of their comparative cheapness. I don't mean to say that it's easy to build and maintain nuclear weapons, but if you compare the price of building and maintaining nuclear weapons with the price of maintaining conventional armies on the ground, the nuclear weapons cost less. They're very, very destructive, and they're relatively economical. That means that for a democracy like the United States, they're an extremely attractive option as the basis for the nation's foreign policy. Because American politicians, who themselves always want to be, or nearly always want to be, re-elected, are aware that one of the very best ways to get re-elected is to be in favor of cutting taxes, or to actually cut taxes. So nuclear weapons offer a powerful defense policy on the cheap. In fact, this insight was embodied in one of the names for the Eisenhower foreign policy, more bang for the buck, a lot of explosive power for a relatively small cost. Because the Soviet Union was autocratic and didn't have representative democracy, the Russians weren't constrained in the same way. They could devote far more of their gross national product to weapons development and build both a powerful nuclear arsenal and maintain massive conventional forces as well. So that throughout the Cold War, in terms of conventional soldiers, the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet powers, usually had far more soldiers deployed than the Americans did. That's one of the reasons why the Americans would never disavow potential first use of nuclear weapons, because they could anticipate that if there was a conventional Soviet invasion of Western Europe with conventional troops, it would only be through the use of battlefield nuclear weapons that the Americans would be able to repel them. So that's another of the issues which conditions Cold War military thinking. Of course, also, if you have a small conventional army and a nuclear-based defense policy, far less American people have to serve in the army. You don't have to draft them. And that's also another politically popular option, not forcing people to do military service. So throughout the long standoff between 1946 and 89, the Americans knew that they probably couldn't withstand a conventional invasion of West Germany and would have to resort to first use. But the great downside of nuclear weapons, and especially an entire foreign policy based on them, is that they're too destructive. They're so catastrophic in their effects that no that it's hard to find an incident adequate to deserve retaliation in nuclear form. So if you're basing your defense policy on nuclear weapons, it tends to become rigid. It lacks the flexibility of smaller scale responses. Well, deterrence was the basis of this policy. In other words, each side, because it's got the nuclear weapons, deters an attack from the other side because the adversary thinks, if we attack, perhaps we'll suffer nuclear attack as the consequence. Nuclear deterrence. It was central to the Cold War. And in the actual 44-year standoff, they never were used. Each side dreaded the consequences of the other side's retaliation. This also became a fertile source of fictional scenarios. If you've seen the wonderful film Dr. Strangelove, you can perhaps remember the way in which the Americans accidentally launch a nuclear attack on the Russians, not meaning to, because one of their own generals has gone mad. And in doing so, they trigger what the Soviets call the doomsday machine, which will massively retaliate against them. It's a black comedy, but full of interesting references to what was actually going on in the Cold War. Failsafe was another one, or more recently, the film War Games from the early 1980s, each of which coincided with citizens' protest movements against nuclear weapons. Nuclear war gaming created complex logical sequences as defense planners thought about how you should think about using them. For example, by the 60s, when more and more of this defense policy was based on missiles in silos, what should your targets be? Should you target the enemy's cities, or should you target the enemy's missile silos? Well, at first glance, it might seem as though the best thing to do would be to target the missiles, because it's more humane. You're not threatening massive populations. But then, the only reason to attack a silo would be if the missile was still in it. In other words, the implication is that you're planning a first strike, because there's no point in hitting an empty silo. So actually what happened is that the targeting policy was to target the cities as a way of reassuring the adversary. We're only going to attack if you attack us first. It's actually a little way of de-escalating, and therefore contributes to stability. In the same way, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972 argued the superiority of not having having missile defenses in each country, because they imply that what you might try to do is to launch a first strike against the enemy and then shoot down his retaliatory strikes. Better to make yourself defenseless as a way of bearing witness to the fact that you've got no intention of striking first. Weird counter-instinctual ways of thinking about defense policy. And then concepts like MAD, M-A-D, mutual assured destruction, and overkill are also some of the euphemisms of this period. The knowledge that each side could completely destroy the entire population of the other. This meant that the Russians and the Americans, despite their profound mistrust, were in some way negotiating with each other over weapons policy. They faced common problems in deciding how to use them. In 1963, for example, they both signed the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty. Both sides recognized that there'd been so many nuclear tests in the 50s that the background level of radiation in the atmosphere was increasing, and that rates of diseases like leukemia, skin cancer, were also increasing very rapidly, which could be traced to radiation. So they commonly agreed that from now on their tests would take place only underground, where the radiation effects could be contained, using seismic measurements to test the force of the blasts. Many influential Americans opposed dependence on nuclear weapons altogether, and there were two great anti-nuclear movements, the first culminating in the early 60s and the second culminating in the early 80s. The theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who I mentioned previously, in a wonderful book called The Irony of American History, published in 1952, said, we claim that we're using these nuclear weapons as a way of protecting our civilization. But if we were to use such weapons, such destructive weapons, we'd be demonstrating by the use of them that we're not civilized at all. It's totally incompatible with our claim to be a Judeo-Christian civilization that we'd even think about using a weapon of this magnitude of destruction. In the early 1980s, the American Catholic bishops wrote a pastoral letter against nuclear weapons. It's called The Challenge of Peace, causing great anxiety to the Reagan administration because it put a church to which about a third of the American people belong officially on record as condemning America's the basis of America's defense policy. Well, the nuclear confrontation underlay every element of American foreign policy. Although the nuclear war possibility wasn't always in the foreground, in fact, it was usually in the background, it was always there, and it conditioned everything else which happened in the Cold War years, certainly subsidiary wars like the wars in Korea and Vietnam, along with all the struggles surrounding post-colonial Africa, had the antagonists constantly in mind of the nuclear threat which lay behind them all.